I always feel the pressure to find the perfect gift for my relatives. In this case, whether you're sending an unforgettable gift or treating yourself to everyday perfection, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. For me, I'm not just into steaks. I like all types of meat. That's why I'll usually get the Winter's Bestseller Pack. It comes with juicy fillets, chicken breast, pork chops, and even burgers. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. A family-owned company with over 100 years of experience in the meat industry. Save big on unforgettable gifts with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide and earn an extra 20% off select favorites during their cyber sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code YUM at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. Go to omahasteaks.com to get 50% off site-wide plus an extra 20% off select favorites and more limited-time deals during their cyber sale. And use promo code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
Section 17 of A History of the Papacy, Volume 2 by Mandel Creighton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Pamela Nagami. Book 3. The Council of Basel, 1419-1425. Chapter 1. Martin V and Italian Affairs, 1419-1425, Part 1. On leaving Constance, Martin V felt himself for the first time free. He had been taught by the events of the last 4 years that freedom was only possible for a pope in Italy, in spite of all the temporary inconveniences which might arise from Italian politics. But much as he might desire to find himself in his native city and revive the glories of the papacy in its old historic seat, he could not immediately proceed to Rome. John the 23rd had abandoned Rome and had been driven even to flee from Bologna, owing to his political helplessness and the power of his opponent Ladislaus. The death of Ladislaus and the abeyance of the papacy had only plunged Italian affairs into deeper confusion, and Martin V had to pause a while and consider how he could best return to Italy. Through the Swiss cantons, Martin made a triumphal progress and had no reason to complain of want of respect or lack of generosity. On June 11th, he reached Geneva, and in the city of the Prince Bishop he stayed for 3 months. There he had the satisfaction of receiving the allegiance of the citizens of Avignon. He seems to have wished to display himself as much as possible and exert the prestige of the restored papacy to secure his position. At the end of September, he moved slowly from Geneva through Savoy to Turin, and thence through Pavia to Milan, where he was received with great honor by Filippo Maria Visconti on October 12th. So great was the popular curiosity to see the Pope that when he went to consecrate a new altar in the cathedral, several people were trampled to death in the throng. At Milan, Martin showed his desire for the pacification of Italy by making terms between Filippo Maria and Pandolfo Malatesta, who had seized on Brescia. There, too, he received ambassadors from the Florentines, who, in their capacity of peacemakers, were anxious to arrange matters so as to enable the Pope to return quietly to Rome. They offered him a refuge in their city, and also their services as mediators. On October 19th, Martin left Milan for Brescia, and on October 25th he entered Mantua. There he stayed till the end of the year, seeking for some means to make the papal influence a real power in Italian affairs. At length, he resolved to accept the services of the Florentines and set out for their city, avoiding on his way the rebellious Bologna, which had cast off the papal rule. On February 26, 1419, he entered Florence, where he was honorably received, and took up his abode in the monastery of Santa Maria Novella. The condition of Italy was indeed sufficiently disturbed to need all the efforts of the Pope and of Florence to reduce it to order and peace. In Lombardy, Filippo Maria, Duke of Milan, was bent on winning back the lands of his father, John Galeazzo, which had fallen into the hands of petty tyrants. Southern Italy was thrown into confusion by the death of Ladislaus, who was succeeded in the kingdom of Naples by his sister Giovanna II, a woman with none of the qualities of a ruler, who used her position solely as a means of personal gratification. The death of Louis of Anjou gave every hope of a peaceful reign to the distracted Neapolitan kingdom, but Giovanna's ungovernable passions soon made it a sphere of personal intrigue. At first the queen, a widow of 47 years old, was under the control of a lover, Pandolfo Alapo, whom she made chamberlain and covered with her favors. To maintain his position against the discontented barons, Alapo formed an alliance with Sforza, who was made Grand Constable of Naples. But the barons insisted that the queen should marry, and in 1415 she chose for her husband Jacques de Bourbon, Count of La Marche. The barons sided with the Count of La Marche, who by their aid imprisoned Sforza, put Alapo to death, and exercised the power of king. The favor, however, which he showed to his own countrymen, the French, disgusted the Neapolitan nobles, and in 1416 Giovanna was able again to assert her own power. By this time she had a new favorite to direct her, Giovanni Caraccioli, who drove the king to leave Naples and thought it wise also to find an occupation for Sforza, which would keep him at a distance. For this purpose he sent him on an expedition against Braccio, who had attacked the states of the church and had advanced against Rome. Andrea Braccio, of the family of the Counts of Montone, was a noble Perugian, who in his youth had been driven by party struggles to leave his native city and had embraced the calling of a condottieri under Alberigo da Barbiano. He served on many sides in the Italian wars, and finally was in the pay of Ladislaus, who played him false in an attack upon Perugia, whereon Braccio joined the side of John the 23rd, who left him governor of Bologna when he set out for Constance. Braccio was possessed with a desire to make himself master of his native city of Perugia, and in 1416 sold the Bolognesi their liberty and hired soldiers on every side. He defeated Carlo Malatesta, whom the Perugians called to their aid, and in July 1416 made himself master of the city. Soon desirous of enlarging his territory, he advanced into the states of the church. Todi, Rieti, and Narni soon fell before him, and he pressed on to the neighborhood of Rome. But Braccio, to win Perugia, had drawn to his side the condottieri general Tartaglia, who stipulated in return for his services that Braccio should not oppose him in attacking the dominions of Sforza. From that time Sforza conceived a deadly hatred against Braccio, and for the next few years the history of Italy is an account of the desperate rivalry of these two rival condottieri. Rome, during the abeyance of the papacy, was left in an anomalous condition. The castle of St. Angelo, which had been taken by Ladislaus, was still held by a Neapolitan governor. John the 23rd, on departing for Constance, had appointed Cardinal Isolani his legate in Rome, and he was assisted or hindered by the presence of the Cardinal of Sant'Angelo, Pietro delle Stefanacci, who found Rome preferable to Constance. The legate Isolani managed to retain considerable influence over the Romans and induced them to carry on the government of the city according to the constitution established before the interference of Ladislaus. But Rome was in no condition to offer resistance to Braccio when he advanced against it, and on June 9, 1417, took up his position by Sant'Agnese. In vain the legate tried to negotiate for his departure. Braccio harried the adjacent country and reduced the Romans to capitulate through hunger. He had an ally in the Cardinal Stefanacci, who welcomed him on his triumphal entry on June 16th, and helped him to form a new magistracy. the legate fled into the castle of Sant'Angelo and begged for help from Naples. His entreaties were heard, as Sforza was burning for revenge against Braccio, and Giovanna's new favorite, Caraccioli, was looking about for some means of getting rid of Sforza, whose manly frame might soon prove too attractive to the susceptible queen. Braccio was engaged in besieging the castle of Sant'Angelo when the arrival of Sforza on August 10th warned him of his danger. Sforza, seeing how matters stood, went to Ostia and crossed the Tiber without hindrance. When Braccio heard that he was advancing against him, he judged it unwise to risk the loss of his newly won possessions, and on August 26th withdrew to Perugia. Sforza entered Rome in triumph with the banners of Naples and of the Church. He restored the legate Isolani to power, appointed new magistrates, and imprisoned the traitorous Cardinal of Sant'Angelo, who died soon afterwards. Such was the condition of affairs which Martin V had to face on his election. It was natural that his first movement should be towards alliance with Giovanna II of Naples, seeing that the Neapolitan influence seemed most powerful in Rome. He welcomed Giovanna's ambassadors and sent a cardinal to arrange matters with the queen as early as May 1418. Giovanna agreed to restore all the possessions of the church and make a perpetual alliance with the pope, who was to crown her queen of Naples. She gave a pledge of her sincerity by the usual means of enriching the pope's relations. Martin's brother, Giordano Colonna, was made Duke of Amalfi and Venosa. His nephew, Antonio, was made Grand Chamberlain of Naples, and on August 21st appeared with a bull announcing the pope's alliance with Giovanna. Antonio at first attached himself to the favorite, Caraccioli, but before the end of the year, Sforza was strong enough to organize a popular rising against the favorite, who was forced to leave Naples and was sent as ambassador to Martin V at Mantua. There the surrender of the fortresses which the Neapolitans occupied in the States of the Church and the coronation of Giovanna was finally arranged. Early in 1419, a papal legate was sent to Naples to perform the coronation. Thus matters stood when Martin took refuge in Florence. He could do nothing better than await the course of events in Naples and the results of the Florentine mediation. Return to Rome with Braccio hostile was impossible. If Braccio were to be overthrown, it could only be by the arms of Sforza. But the pope's first steps had been to ally with Giovanna and Caraccioli, with whom Sforza was now at enmity. At Florence, Martin's prestige was increased by the arrival of four of Benedict XIII's cardinals, who were solemnly received on March 17th. So far as Italy was concerned, Martin V had nothing to fear from Peter de Luna. But the deposed Baldassare Cossa was still an object of his dread, for Braccio had threatened to espouse Cossa's cause and might again raise him to the position of a dangerous rival. Accordingly, Martin was very anxious to get Cossa into his hands, and the Florentines, in the interests of peace, were desirous that this matter should be arranged. John XXIII, when legate of Bologna, had always been on good terms with the Florentines, and had stood in friendly relations with several of the richest citizens, amongst whom were Giovanni de' Medici and Niccolò d'Auzzano, who were now ready to interfere in his behalf. They procured from Martin V a promise that he would deal gently with his deposed predecessor, and advanced the sum of 38,500 Rhenish ducats to buy the release of Cossa from Louis of Bavaria, in whose custody he was. On his way to Florence, Cossa was escorted by the Bishop of Lübeck, who was charged by Martin V to keep a sharp eye upon him. At Parma, he lodged with an old friend, who alarmed him with rumors that Martin V meant to have him imprisoned for life at Mantua. He fled by night to Genoa, where he found protection from the doge Tommaso di Campo Fregoso. Friends quickly gathered round him, urging him once more to try his fortunes and assert his claims to the papacy. For a brief space there was a thrill of horror, lest the miseries of the schism should again begin. But the wise counsels of Giovanni de' Medici and his Florentine friends seemed to have prevailed with Cosa. They assured him of his safety and urged him to fulfill his promise. John the 23rd no longer possessed his former vigor or felt his old confidence in himself and his fortunes. The helplessness which had overtaken him at Constance still haunted him, and though the old spirit might rekindle for a moment, it was soon chilled by doubt and hesitation. He judged it wisest to trust his friends, proceed to Florence, and submit to the mercy of Martin V. On June the 14th, he entered Florence and was received with respectful pity by the entire body of the citizens. The sight of one who had fallen from a high degree kindled their sympathy, and Cosa's poor apparel and miserable look impressed more vividly the sense of his changed fortunes. On June 27th, he appeared before Martin in full consistory, and kneeling before him made his submission. "I alone," he said, "assembled the council. I always labored for the good of the church. You know the truth. I come to your holiness and rejoice as much as I can at your elevation and my own freedom." Here his voice was broken with passion. His haughty nature could ill brook his humiliation. Martin received him graciously and placed on his head the cardinal's hat. But Cosa did not long live under the shadow of his successor. He died in the same year on December 23rd, and his Florentine friends were faithful to his memory. In the stately baptistry of Florence, the Medici erected to him a splendid tomb. The recumbent figure cast in bronze was the work of Donatello, and the marble pedestal which supports it was wrought by Michelozzo. It bears the simple inscription, "Johannes, quondam papa, vi gintitres, obiit Florentiae." Martin V's attention was meanwhile directed to the kingdom of Naples, and he urged on Giovanna II the duty of restoring to his obedience the states of the church. Giovanna was not sorry to rid herself of Sforza, for she longed to recall her favorite, Caraccioli. Sforza was dispatched to war against Braccio, but on June 20th was defeated at Monte Fiesone near Viterbo. But Martin was enabled to detach Tartaglia from Braccio's side, and Sforza could again set an army in the field in the name of Naples and the Pope. He was not, however, supported from Naples, for Giovanna had recalled Caraccioli, and the favorite thought it better to leave Sforza to his fate. Martin saw that nothing was to be gained from a further alliance with Giovanna II and Caraccioli. Moreover, the question of the Neapolitan succession was again imminent, for Giovanna was over 50 years of age and was childless. Louis III of Anjou had already begged Martin to procure from Giovanna II a formal recognition of his claim, and the Pope judged that the opportunity was favorable for action. Sforza was weary of the selfish policy of Caraccioli, and the Neapolitan barons resented the rule of the insolent favorite. The Florentines offered Martin V their aid to mediate between him and Braccio. The Pope saw an opportunity of making himself the central figure in the politics of southern Italy. At peace with Braccio and allied with Sforza, he might settle the succession to Naples in favor of Louis of Anjou and end the Neapolitan difficulty, which had so long harassed his predecessors. In January 1420, Sforza paid Martin V a visit in Florence, and the Pope broached his views, to which, with some reluctance, Sforza gave his adhesion. Scarcely had Sforza departed before Braccio, at the end of February, made a triumphal entry into Florence, there to celebrate his reconciliation with the Pope. With a splendid escort of 400 horsemen and 40 foot, with deputies from the various cities under his rule, Braccio entered the city in grandeur that awoke the enthusiastic acclamations of the Florentines. In the middle of the bands of horsemen, gleaming in gold and silver armor, mounted on splendid steeds richly caparisoned, rode Braccio, clad in purple and gold, on a steed whose trappings were of gold. He was a man rather above the middle height, with an oval face that seemed too full of blood, yet with a look of dignity and power that, in spite of his limbs maimed with wounds, marked him as a ruler of men. Amid the shouts of the thronging citizens, Braccio visited the Pope and paid him haughty reverence. After a few days spent in negotiations, an alliance was made between Martin V and Braccio, by which Braccio was left in possession of Perugia, Assisi, and other towns which he had won, on condition of reducing Bologna to obedience to the Pope. Martin V's pride was sorely hurt by the avowed preference which the Florentines showed to the condottiere over the Pope. The Florentine boys expressed the common feeling by a doggerel rhyme, which they sang in the streets and which soon reached the ears of the sensitive Pope. Braccio valente, vince ogni gente, il Papa Martino non vale un quattrino. Braccio the Great conquers every state. Poor Pope Martin is not worth a farthing. He was glad to see Braccio leave Florence, and hoped that the task of reducing Bologna would occupy him long enough to enable Sforza to make his attack on Giovanna, unimpeded by Braccio's hostility. Braccio, however, rapidly gathered his forces and conducted matters with such skill that on July 22nd the Pope's legate took possession of Bologna. End of section 17. Section 18 of A History of the Papacy, Volume 2, by Mandell Creighton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Pamela Nagami. Book 3, Chapter 1, Martin V and Italian Affairs, 1419-1425, Part 2. Meanwhile, Sforza hastened the preparations against Giovanna II. On June 18th, he suddenly raised the standard of the Duke of Anjou and began to make war against Naples. On August 19th, 10 Angevin galleys made their appearance off the Neapolitan coast. Louis of Anjou eagerly caught at Martin V's offer of protection. He did not scruple to leave France in the hands of the English and abandon his land of Provence to the hostile attacks of the Duke of Savoy, that he might pursue the phantom kingdom of Naples, which had proved disastrous to his father and his grandfather alike. Giovanna II, seeing herself thus threatened, cast about on her part also for allies. She sent an ambassador to the Pope, whose hostility was not yet declared, but the subtle Neapolitan easily saw through the Pope's equivocal answers to his demands. There was in Florence at the papal court an ambassador of Alfonso V of Aragon. To him in his strait the Neapolitan turned. He reminded him that the House of Aragon had as good a claim to Naples as the House of Anjou. Giovanna II was childless and could dispose of her kingdom as she chose. If Alfonso succored her in her strait, he might count upon her gratitude. This proposal was very acceptable to Alfonso V, a young and ambitious king. By the death of Martin of Sicily without children in 1409, the kingdom of Sicily had been attached to that of Aragon, and Alfonso was keenly alive to the advantage of annexing Naples also. At the time that Giovanna's offer reached him, he was engaged in prosecuting against the Genoese his claims on the island of Corsica, where, after a long siege, the desperate efforts of the Genoese threatened to render his undertaking hopeless. His ambassador at Florence was endeavoring to obtain from Martin V a recognition of Alfonso's claim to Corsica, but Alfonso V at once saw the policy of abandoning a doubtful attempt upon a barren island for the more alluring prize of the Neapolitan kingdom. He dispatched from Corsica to the relief of Giovanna II 15 galleys, which arrived off Naples on September 6th, and Giovanna II showed her gratitude by adopting him as her son. War was now let loose upon Naples. Alfonso and Giovanna sought to strengthen themselves by an alliance with Braccio. Martin V's policy had succeeded in providing occupation for all whom he had most to dread. He was now in a position to take advantage of the general confusion and, amid the weakness of all parties, raise once more the prestige of the papal name. He had gained all that was to be gained from a stay in Florence, and might now with safety venture to Rome. Moreover, Martin V was not oversatisfied with the impression which he had produced on the Florentines. The common sense of the quick-witted commercial city was not taken in by high-sounding claims or magnificent ecclesiastical processions. The Florentines had shown for Braccio an admiration which they refused to Martin V. However much Martin might wrap himself in his dignity and affect to despise popular opinion, he yet felt that in Florence nothing succeeded like success, and that a fortunate freebooter ranked above a landless pope. The bustling, pushing spirit of a prosperous commercial city was alien to the papacy, which could only flourish amidst the traditions and aspirations of the past. A few days before his departure for Rome, Martin V could not refrain from showing his wounded pride to Leonardo Bruni, who was present in the library of Santa Maria Novella. For some time Martin V walked gloomily up and down the room, gazing out of the window upon the garden below. At last he stopped before Leonardo, and in a voice quivering with scorn, repeated the doggerel of the Florentine mob, "Poor Pope Martin isn't worth a farthing." Leonardo tried to appease him by saying that such trifles were not worthy of notice, but the Pope again repeated the lines in the same tone. Anxious for the fair fame of Florence, Leonardo at once undertook its defense and pointed out to the Pope the practical advantages which he had derived from his stay: the recovery of some of the states of the Church, and especially of Bologna, the submission of John XXIII, the reconciliation with Braccio. Where else, he asked, could such advantages have been so easily obtained? The Pope's gloomy brow grew clearer before the words of the Florentine secretary. Martin departed with goodwill from Florence, thanked its magistrates for their kind offices, and marked his gratitude to the city by erecting the bishopric of Florence to the dignity of an archbishopric. On September 9th, Martin V journeyed from Florence with due respect from the citizens. On September 20th, he was honorably received in Siena, and used his opportunity to borrow 15,000 florins, for which he gave Spoleto as a pledge. From Siena he proceeded through Viterbo to Rome, which he entered on September 28th, and took up his abode by Santa Maria del Popolo. Next day he was escorted to the Vatican by the city magistrates, and the people, bearing lighted torches and clamorous with joy. The Romans had indeed occasion to hail any change that might restore their shattered fortunes. Everything that had happened in late years had tended to plunge them deeper and deeper in misery and ruin. The havoc wrought by the invasions of Ladislaus, of Sforza, and of Braccio, the absence of the Pope and consequent loss of traffic, the want of all authority in the papal states, the pillage that wasted up to the walls of Rome, all these combined to reduce the city to wretchedness and desolation. Martin V found Rome so devastated that it hardly looked like a city. Houses were in decay, churches in ruins, the streets were empty, filth and dirt were everywhere. Food was so scarce and dear that men could hardly keep themselves alive. Civilization seemed almost extinct. The Romans looked like the scum of the earth. Martin V had a hard task before him to bring back order and decency into the ruined city. It was his great merit that he set himself diligently to put matters straight, and that he succeeded in reclaiming its capital for the restored papacy. His first care was to provide for the administration of justice and put down the robbers who infested Rome and its neighborhood, for the purpose of pillaging the pious pilgrims who visited the tombs of the apostles. But much had to be done to repair the ravages of preceding years, and new disasters rendered the task more difficult. In November 1422, the town was overwhelmed by a flood in the Tiber, occasioned by Braccio's destruction of the wall of the Lago di Piediluco, the old Velline Lake. The water rose to the height of the high altar in the Pantheon, and as it subsided, carried away the flocks from the fields and caused great destruction of property. In Naples, little was done worthy of the great efforts which were made. Alfonso's reinforcements checked the victorious career of Louis of Anjou and Sforza, till in June 1421, Braccio brought his forces to Giovanna's aid. Alfonso himself arrived in Naples, and the Pope dispatched Tartaglia to the aid of Louis. Alfonso and Braccio engaged in a fruitless siege of Acerra. Nothing serious was done, as the condottieri generals were engaged in a series of intrigues against one another. Sforza accused Tartaglia of treachery, seized him, and put him to death. Tartaglia's soldiers, indignant at the treatment of their leader, joined Braccio, who was anxious only to secure his own principality of Capua. Martin V was weary of finding supplies, and was embarrassed by Alfonso's threats that he would again recognize Benedict XIII. Caraccioli was afraid of Alfonso's resolute character, and sowed discord between him and Giovanna. Alfonso, on his part, was perplexed by the queen's doubtful attitude toward him. As everyone had his own reasons for desiring peace, the Pope's mediation was accepted for that purpose in March 1422. Aversa and Castellammare, the only two places which Louis held, were surrendered to the papal legate, who soon afterwards gave them over to the queen. Braccio and Sforza were outwardly reconciled, and Sforza joined the side of Giovanna, only with the purpose of favoring more surely the party of Louis. Louis himself withdrew to Rome, where he lived for 2 years at the Pope's expense, awaiting the results of Sforza's machinations. But this peace and its reconciliation were alike hollow. The mutual suspicions of Alfonso and Giovanna II went on increasing till in May 1423, Alfonso determined on a decisive blow. He suddenly imprisoned Caraccioli and made a dash to obtain the person of the queen, who was in the Castel Capuano at Naples. The attempt to surprise the queen failed, and Alfonso besieged the castle. But Sforza hastened to the queen's aid, and though his army was smaller than Alfonso's, he gave his men fresh courage by pointing to the splendid equipments of the Aragonese, raising the battle cry, "Fine clothes and good horses," footnote, "Ali ben vestiti, ali ben a cavalli." He led his men to the charge. His inducement proved to be sufficiently strong. He won the day, and Alfonso in his turn was besieged in the Castel Nuovo. After this failure, the fortunes of Louis of Anjou began to revive. Caraccioli was ransomed from prison, and he and Sforza urged Giovanna to cancel the adoption of the ungrateful Alfonso and accept Louis as her successor. At the end of June, Louis arrived in Naples, and his adoption as Giovanna's heir was formally accomplished with the Pope's sanction. Alfonso's hope now rested on the prompt aid of Braccio. But Braccio entered the Neapolitan kingdom through the Abruzzi and set himself to besiege the wealthy city of Aquila, that he might obtain booty for his soldiers. The defense was obstinate, and the siege slowly dragged on. In vain Alfonso besought Braccio to quit it. The stubborn condottiere refused. Meanwhile, Filippo Maria Visconti, who had by this time secured his possessions in Lombardy, and had moreover made himself master of Genoa, offered help to Giovanna. He did not wish that an active king like Alfonso should establish himself in Naples and urge troublesome claims to the Genoese possessions. Alfonso was afraid lest he might lose his command of the sea before the attack of the Genoese galleys, and he also received disquieting news from Aragon. Weary with waiting for Braccio, who never came, he sailed away on October 15th and revenged himself on Louis by sacking Marseille on his homeward voyage. The departure of Alfonso relieved Martin V of a troublesome enemy, but his attention in this year, 1423, had to be directed to an equally troublesome matter. It was now 5 years since the dissolution of the Council of Constance, and the period for holding the next council had arrived. Already in 1422, the University of Paris sent ambassadors to urge Martin V to fulfill his promise. Among the envoys of the university was a learned Dominican, John Stojkovich, a native of Ragusa in Dalmatia, who stayed at Rome to watch Martin's proceedings and be ready for the council as soon as it was summoned. Pavia had been fixed at Constance for its place of meeting, but in his letters of summons, Martin V was careful to express his fervor in behalf of the council by saying that if Pavia was found unsuitable, he was resolved to call it to a more convenient place rather than it should dissolve. The Transalpine prelates were not inspirited by this kindly assurance. They felt that a council in an Italian city was as good as useless. Martin V had taken no steps in the way of reforming the abuses of the church. The state of Christendom was not favorable for a council. In England, Henry V was dead, and the minority of Henry VI had already begun to open up intrigues and jealousies. France was exhausted by its war with England. In Germany, Sigismund was engaged in a war with the Hussites in Bohemia and had no time to spend in talk. There was nothing to encourage men to undertake the costly journey to Italy, where Martin V was likely to employ them on the barren subject of a proposed union between the Eastern and Western churches. When the council was opened on April 23, 1423, by the four prelates whom the Pope had nominated as presidents, it was not largely attended. Few came from beyond the Alps, and the absence of Italians showed that the Pope's influence was used against the council from the beginning. Scarcely were the opening formalities at an end when the outbreak of the plague gave a reason for removing elsewhere, and the council decided to go to Siena, where on July 2nd it resumed its labors. The first step of the council was to organize itself according to nations and to determine who should have the right of voting. All prelates, abbots, graduates of universities who were in orders, rectors, ambassadors of kings, barons and universities were to be admitted freely. Other ecclesiastics were to be judged of by the nation to which they belonged. Each nation was to have a president elected every month, who, together with chosen deputies, was to prepare the business to be discussed by the nation according to the wishes of the majority. While making these arrangements, the council repeatedly sent to the Pope, urging him to come to Siena, and their request was confirmed by the city magistrates, who showed themselves amenable to the Pope's will, by granting a safe conduct in the terms which he demanded. But when the safe conduct was known at Siena, the fathers saw their liberty directly menaced by it. All magistrates and officials in the Sienese territories were to take oath of allegiance to the Pope, a proceeding which left the council entirely at the Pope's mercy. Moreover, the members of the council were to be subject to the jurisdiction of the Pope's officers. The whole tenor of the Articles of Agreement was insulting to the council and gave manifest signs of the Pope's ill will. In its formal language, the officials of the Curia were named before the members of the council. The energy of the council was forthwith turned to negotiate with the Sienese for a safe conduct, which would give them greater security from the Pope. Meanwhile, Martin V showed himself more decidedly hostile, and his presidents used all efforts to weaken the councillor party. Letters from Rome poured into Siena. Tempting promises of promotion were held out to those who showed signs of wavering. End of section 18. Section 19 of A History of the Papacy, Volume 2 by Mandell Creighton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain, read by Pamela Nagami. Book 3, Chapter 1, Martin V and Italian Affairs, 1419 to 1425, Part 3. The reforming party felt that something must be done. They settled the matter of the safe conduct and agreed to pass some decrees on which there could be no difference of opinion. On November 6th, a session of the council was held which declared that the work of reform must begin with the foundation of the faith, and consequently condemn the errors of Wycliffe and Huss, and denounce the partisans of Peter de Luna, approved of negotiations for union with the Greek Church, and exhorted all Christian men to root out heresy wherever they found it. After this, the reforming party urged that the work left unachieved at Constance should be resumed, and the French nation put forward a memorandum sketching a plan of reform according to the lines laid down at Constance. The curial party resolved on resistance, and the small numbers present at Siena rendered personal pressure tolerably easy. John of Ragusa, though wishing to make the council seem as numerous as possible, can only count 2 cardinals and 25 mitred prelates as representatives of the higher clergy at the session on November 6th. The curial party thought it best to throw the machinery of the nations into confusion. They managed to cause disputed elections to the office of president, both in the French and in the Italian nation, in the month of January 1424. The papal legates offered their services to the French to judge in this dispute. The French answered that on matters concerning a nation in the council, no one, not even the Pope, could judge but the council itself. They asked the presidents to summon a congregation for the purpose. The presidents refused, whereupon the French called the other nations together on January 10th, and afterwards drew up their grievances in the shape of a protest, which they lodged with the legates. Meanwhile, the legates were busily engaged in strengthening their party within each nation, so as to prevent any possibility of unanimity. While thus the nations were divided, the legates steadily pursued the dissolution of the council, and, as a first step toward this, urged the appointment of deputies to fix the meeting place of the next council. This question in itself aroused antagonism. The French wished the future council to be held in France. This excited the national jealousy of the Germans and English. The curial party openly avowed that they never wished to see another council at all, and opposed the decrees of Constance. There were hopes, however, of renewed concord, when on February 12th, the Archbishop of Rouen and the ambassadors of the University of Paris arrived at Siena. They interposed to heal the dissension among the French, and the Archbishop of Rouen was, by a compromise, elected to the office of President of the French nation. The compromise was, however, fatal. The Archbishop of Rouen had been already won over by the legates, and the ambassadors of the university had a greater desire to go to Rome and seek favors for themselves than stay at Siena and watch over the reformation of the church. On February 19th, deputies from all the nations agreed in choosing Basel as the meeting place for the next council to be held in 7 years. The dissolution of the council was now felt to be imminent. Only a few zealous reformers had hopes of further business, and they were aided by the citizens of Siena, who did not see why they should not enjoy the same luck as Constance and reap a golden harvest for some years to come. But Martin V knew how to address rebellious citizens. He sternly bade them not to put their sickles into another's sheaves, nor think that general councils were held or dissolved to please them or fill their pockets. Still the Sienese were resolved to make a last attempt, and on February 20th laid the Pope's letters before the nations, and shut their gates to prevent the desertions which were thinning the council's ranks. But the reformers were not strong enough to accept the citizens' help. The council sent to request the gates to be opened. Meanwhile, the legates were ready to dissolve the council. The reformers were anxious to continue their work. At last, on March 7th, the legates, taking advantage of the solitude produced by the festivities of the carnival, posted on the door of the cathedral a decree of the dissolution of the council, which had been secretly drawn up on February 26th, and prohibited all from attempting to continue it. On the same day, they hastily left Siena for Florence. Those who remained were too few to hope to accomplish anything. Thomas, abbot of Paisley, who was a member of the French nation, published an energetic protest against the dissolution, which was joined by a few other zealous reformers. Then on March 8th, they held a meeting in which they decided that to avoid scandal to the church and danger to themselves on account of the nearness of the papal power, it was better to depart quietly. The Council of Siena came rapidly to an end, and Martin V could plead the smallness of its numbers, its seditious conduct with the Sienese burghers, and its own internal disorders as reason for its dissolution. Really, the Council of Siena followed too soon upon that of Constance. The position of affairs had not materially changed. The Pope had not yet recovered his normal position in Italy, and those who had been at Constance were not prepared to undertake the labors of a second council when they had nothing to give them any hopes of success. What was impossible with the help of Sigismund was not likely to be more possible in the face of Martin V's determined resistance. Martin V judged it wise, however, to make some promises of reform. As the council had been too full of disturbance to admit of any progress in the matter, he promised to undertake a reform of the Curia and nominated two cardinals as commissioners to gather evidence. The results of Martin V's deliberations were embodied in a constitution published on May 16, 1425. It reads as though it were the Pope's retaliation on the attempt made at Constance to constitute the cardinals as an official aristocracy which was to direct the Pope's actions. Martin V provided for decorous and good living on the part of the cardinals, forbade them to exercise the position of protectors of the interests of kings or princes at the papal court, or to receive money as protectors for monastic orders. They were not to appear in the streets with a larger retinue than 20 attendants. They were, if possible, to live near the churches whence they took their titles, and were to restore the dilapidated buildings and see to the proper performance of divine service. Similarly, the duties of the proto-notaries and abbreviators of the papal chancery were defined and regulated. Archbishops, bishops, and abbots were ordered to keep strict residence and hold provincial synods three times every year for the redress of abuses. All oppressive exactions on the part of ordinaries were forbidden, and propriety of life was enjoined. Finally, the Pope withdrew many of his rights of reservation as a favor to the ordinaries as patrons. Martin V considered that he had now amply fulfilled all that reformers could require at his hands, and could look around him with greater assurance. He was free for 7 years from the troubles of a council, and could turn his attention to the object he had most at heart, the recovery of the States of the Church, which Alfonso's withdrawal from Naples had rendered a practicable measure. Fortune favored him in this respect beyond his hopes. The desperate resistance which Aquila continued to offer to Braccio encouraged Sforza to march to its relief. On his way there, in January 1424, finding some difficulty in crossing the river Pescara, which was swollen by the wind and tide, he rode into the water to encourage his men. Seeing one of his squires swept off his horse, Sforza hastened to his assistance, but losing his balance in attempting to save the drowning man, he was weighed down by his heavy armor. Twice his hands were seen to wave above the flood. Then he disappeared. His body was swept out to sea and was never found. Thus died Sforza at the age of 54, one of the most notable men in Italian history. His death tells us the secret of his power. He died in the performance of an act of chivalrous generosity to a comrade. However torturous he might be in political relations, to his soldiers he was frank and genial. They loved him and knew that their lives and fortunes were as dear to Sforza as his own. Nor did the more accomplished Braccio long survive his sturdy rival. In spite of the withdrawal of Sforza's troops after their leader's death, Aquila still held out. As its possession was regarded as the key to the possession of Naples, Martin V was eager to raise troops for its relief. He found it as easy to arouse the jealousy of the Duke of Milan against Braccio as against Alfonso, and in May a joint army of Naples, Milan, and Pope advanced to the relief of Aquila. Braccio scorned to take advantage of his enemies as they crossed the mountain ridge that led to the town. Though their forces were superior to his own, he preferred to meet them in the open field. An unexpected sortie of the Aquilans threw Braccio's army into confusion. As he rode around exhorting his men to form afresh and renew the fight, a Perugian exile forced his way through the throng, and with the cry, "Down with the oppressor of his country," wounded Braccio in the throat. On the fall of their leader, the soldiers of Braccio gave way, and the siege of Aquila was raised June 2nd. Braccio's haughty spirit would not survive defeat. For 3 days he lay without eating or speaking till he died. Unlike Sforza, he had no grown-up son to inherit his glory. His shattered army rapidly dispersed upon his death. His body was carried to Rome and was buried as that of an excommunicated man in unconsecrated ground before the church of San Lorenzo. Martin V reaped the full benefit of Braccio's death. On July 29th, Perugia opened its gates to the Pope, and the other cities in Braccio's dominion soon followed its example. Martin found himself in undisputed possession of the Papal States. This was a great point to have gained, and Martin had won his triumph by his astute and cautious, if unscrupulous, policy. He had not hesitated to plunge Naples into war, and had trusted to his own acuteness to fish in troubled waters. Fortune had favored him beyond what he could expect, and the only further difficulty that beset him was a rising of Bologna in 1429, which was put down, though not without a stubborn struggle, by Carlo Malatesta. From that time he set himself with renewed zeal and statesmanlike care to organize the restoration of law and order in the Roman territory and the rest of the papal possessions. When we look back upon the wild confusion that he found at his accession, we must recognize in Martin V's pontificate traces of energy and administrative capacity which have been left unrecorded by the annals of the time. The slow and steady enforcement of order and justice is passed by unnoticed, while discord and anarchy are rarely without a chronicler. It is the great merit of Martin V that he won back from confusion and reduced to obedience and order the disorganized states of the church. The policy of Martin V was to bring under one jurisdiction separate communities with their existing rights and privileges, and so to establish a central monarchy on which they all peaceably depended. It was the misfortune of Martin V that his work was thrown away by the wrong-headedness of his successor, and so left no lasting results. Still, Martin V deserves high praise as a successful statesman, though even here he displayed the spirit of a Roman noble rather than of the head of the church. The elevation of the Colonna family was his constant aim, and he left to his successors a conspicuous example of nepotism. His brothers and sisters were enriched at the expense of the church, and their aggrandizement had the disastrous result that it intensified the long-standing feud between the Colonna and the Orsini, and led to a reaction upon Martin's death. So far did Martin V identify himself with his family that, in defiance of the traditions of his office, he took up his abode in the Colonna Palace by the Church of Santi Apostoli, regarding himself more secure amongst the retainers of his house. The same year that saw the deaths of Sforza and Braccio freed Martin V from another enemy. In November 1424 died Benedict XIII, worn out by extreme old age. In his retirement at Peniscola, he had been powerless either for good or ill. Yet the existence of an antipope was hurtful to the papal dignity, and Alfonso's hostility to Martin V threatened to give him troublesome importance. Benedict's death might seem to end the schism, but one of the last acts of the obstinate old man was the creation of four new cardinals. For a time, his death was kept secret till Alfonso's desires were known. At length, in June 1425, three of Benedict's cardinals elected a new pope, Gilles de Mignon, canon of Barcelona, who took the title of Clement VIII. But schism, when once it begins, is contagious. Another of Benedict's cardinals, a Frenchman, Jean Querrer, who was absent at the time and received no notice, elected for himself another pope, who took the title of Benedict XIV. Martin was desirous of getting rid of these pretenders and sent one of his cardinals, brother of the Count de Foix, to negotiate with Alfonso. But Alfonso refused him entrance into his kingdom and ordered Clement VIII to be crowned in Peniscola. Martin summoned Alfonso to Rome to answer for his conduct. Alfonso saw that nothing was to be gained by isolation from the rest of Europe. Time mollified his wrath at the loss of Naples, and in his hopes for the future, it was better to have the Pope for his friend than for his foe. The Cardinal de Foix carried on his negotiations with wise moderation, and was helped by one of the king's counselors, Alfonso Borgia. In the autumn of 1427, Alfonso V received the Pope's legate, agreed to recognize Martin, and accept his good offices to settle disputes between himself and Giovanna II. In July 1429, Mignon laid aside his papal trappings, submitted to Martin, and received the melancholy post of Bishop of Majorca. The good offices of Alfonso Borgia were warmly recognized both by Alfonso V and Martin V, and this ending of the schism had for its abiding consequence in the future the introduction of the Borgia family to the papal court, where they were destined to play an important part. The Pope of Jean Carrère was, of course, a ridiculous phantom, and in 1432 the Count of Armagnac ordered Carrère, who was still obstinate, to be made prisoner and handed over to Martin V. End of section 19. Section 20 of A History of the Papacy, Volume 2, by Mandel Creighton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Pamela Nagami. Book 3, Chapter 2, Martin V and the Papal Restoration, Beginnings of Eugenius IV, 1425-1432, Part 1. As Martin V felt more sure of his position in Italy, and saw the traces of the schism disappear in the outward organization of the Church, he was anxious also to wipe away the anti-papal legislation which in France and England had followed on the confusion caused by the schism of the papacy. In France, Martin V easily succeeded in overthrowing the attempt to establish the liberties of the national church on the basis of royal edicts. Charles VI had issued in 1418 ordinances forbidding money to be exported from the kingdom for the payment of annates or other demands of the court of Rome, and had confirmed the ancient liberties of the Gallican Church as regarded freedom of election to ecclesiastical offices. In February 1422, he had further forbidden appeals to Rome and contempt of the ordinances. But before the end of the year, Charles VI was dead, and the confusion in France was still further increased by the English claims to the succession. The youthful Charles VII was hard-pressed and wished to gain the Pope's support. In February 1425, he issued a decree re-establishing the papal power as regarded the collation to benefices and all exercise of jurisdiction on the same footing as it had been in the days of Clement VII and Benedict XIII. The Parliament, it is true, protested and refused to register the decree. The Pope, for his part, granted an indemnity for what had been done in the past. All the reforming efforts of the University of Paris and its followers were for the time undone. In England, Martin V was not so successful. In 1421 he wrote to Henry V and exhorted him to lose no time in abolishing the prohibitions of his predecessors, the statutes of provisors and primunieri, on the due exercise of the papal rights. Next year, on the accession of King Henry VI, he wrote still more pressingly to the Council of Regency. When nothing was done, he directed his anger against Henry Chicheley, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Chicheley, in 1423, proclaimed indulgences to all who in that year made pilgrimage to Canterbury. Martin indignantly forbade this assumption of papal rights by a subordinate. As the fallen angels wish to set up in the earth their seat against the Creator, so have these presumptuous men endeavored to raise a false tabernacle of salvation against the apostolic seat and the authority of the Roman pontiff, to whom only has God granted this power. It was long since an English archbishop had heard such language from a pope. But Chicheley was not a man of sufficient courage to remonstrate. He withdrew his proclamation, and Martin V had struck a decided blow against the independence of the English episcopate. The restored papacy owed a debt of gratitude to Henry of Winchester for his good offices as mediator at Constance, and immediately after his election, Martin V nominated him cardinal. Chicheley protested against this step as likely to lead to inconveniences, and Henry V declaring that he would rather see his uncle invested with the crown than with a cardinal's hat, forbade his acceptance of the proffered dignity. When the strong hand of Henry V was gone, Beaufort was again nominated cardinal on May 24, 1426. No longer from motives of gratitude, but because the Pope needed his help. In February 1427, he was further appointed papal legate for the purpose of carrying on war against the Hussites. But the Pope still pursued his main object, and in a letter to the Bishop of Winchester, denounced still more strongly the execrable statute of primunieri, by which the King of England disposed of the affairs of the Church, as though himself and not the Pope were the divinely appointed vicar of Christ. He bade him remember the glorious example of St. Thomas of Canterbury, who did not hesitate to offer himself as a sacrifice on behalf of the liberties of the Church. He bade him urge the abolition of this statute on the council, on Parliament, and on the clergy, that they may preach about it to the people, and he asked to be informed what steps were taken in compliance with his commands. He wrote also in the same strain to the University of Oxford. Indeed, so deeply did Martin V resent the ecclesiastical attitude of England that he said in a consistory, "Amongst Christians, no states have made ordinances contrary to the liberties of the Church save England and Venice." Martin's instincts taught him truly, and he did his utmost to blunt the edge of the weapon that a century later, was to sever the connection between the English Church and the papacy. Again Martin V wrote haughtily to Chicheley, bidding him and the Archbishop of York set aside the statutes of provisors and recognize the papal right to dispose of benefices in England. Chicheley humbly replied that he was the only person in England who was willing to broach the subject, and it was hard that he should be specially visited by the Pope's displeasure for what he could not help. Martin V retorted by issuing letters to suspend Chicheley from his office as legate, a blow against the privileges and independence of the Archbishops of Canterbury, who, since the days of Stephen Langton, had been recognized as the Pope's ordinary legate, legatus natus, in England. Chicheley so far roused himself as to appeal to a future council against this encroachment. The Pope's letters were seized by royal authority, and the suspension did not take effect. But Chicheley was a timid man, and the condition of affairs in England made him shrink from a breach with the Pope. The Lollards were suppressed but not subdued, and a strong anti-hierarchical feeling simmered amongst the people. In the distracted state of the kingdom, little help was to be gained from the royal power, and Chicheley feared the consequences of an interdict. He called to his help the bishops, the University of Oxford, and several temporal lords, who addressed letters to the Pope, bearing testimony to Chicheley's zeal for the Church, and begging the Pope to be reconciled to him. To Chicheley's letters pleading his excuses, the Pope still answered that the only excuse that he could make was active resistance to the obnoxious statutes. At length, Chicheley in 1428 appeared before the Commons, accompanied by the Archbishop of York and other bishops, and with tears in his eyes pointed out the dangers in which the Church and kingdom were placed by their opposition to the Pope's demands. Parliament was unmoved either by Martin's letters or by Chicheley's half-hearted pleadings. They only petitioned the Pope to restore the Archbishop to his favor. The king wrote in the same sense, and the matter was allowed to drop. Martin V might console himself with the reflection that if he had failed to carry his point and abolish the hateful statutes, he had at least succeeded in humiliating the English episcopate by treating them as creatures of his own. In September 1428, Beaufort made his first appearance in England since his elevation to the cardinalate, and a protest in the king's name was issued against his exercise of any legatine authority within the realm. Next year, the question was raised whether Beaufort, being a cardinal, was justified in officiating as Bishop of Winchester and prelate of the Order of the Garter. The king's council advised Beaufort to waive his right. Meanwhile, Beaufort was allowed to gather troops for a crusade against the Hussites. But the English statesman and the papal counselor came into collision, and the troops, which Beaufort had gathered for a crusade in Bohemia, were turned against France. Beaufort pleaded to the Pope the lame excuse that he had not ventured to disobey the king's commands in this matter, nor would the soldiers have obeyed him if he had done so. Though treacherous, the action of Beaufort was popular. He was allowed, though a cardinal, to take his seat at the king's council, except only when matters were under discussion which concerned the Church of Rome. Really, Beaufort was too much absorbed in deadly personal rivalry with Gloucester to be of any service to the Pope in furthering his attempt to overthrow the liberties of the English Church. But the papacy has never in its history gained so much by definite victories as it has by steady persistency. It was always prepared to take advantage of the internal weakness of any kingdom, and to advance pretensions at times when they were not likely to be resolutely disavowed. In time, they might be heard of again, and when reasserted, could at least claim the prestige of some antiquity. by his treatment of Archbishop Chichley, and by his grant of legatine powers to Beaufort, Martin V exercised a more direct authority over the machinery of the English Church than had been permitted to any pope since the days of Innocent III. The Church was weak in its hold on the affections of the people, and when the kingly office was in abeyance, the Church, robbed of its protector, was too feeble to offer any serious resistance to the papacy. Martin V used his opportunity dexterously, and his successors had no reason to complain of the independent spirit of English bishops. But besides being an ecclesiastic, Martin V had the sentiments of a Roman noble. He wished to restore his native city to some part of her old glory, and labored so assiduously at the work of restoration that a grateful people hailed him as father of his country. He rebuilt the tottering portico of St. Peter's, and proceeded to adorn and repair the ruined basilicas of the city. In the church of St. John Lateran, which had been destroyed by fire in 1308, and was slowly rising from its ruins, he laid down the mosaic pavement which still exists, and built up the roof. He restored the basilica of the Santi Apostoli. His example told upon the cardinals, and he urged on them to undertake the care of the churches from which they took their titles. His pontificate marks the beginning of an era of architectural adornment of the city of Rome. The only part of the work of the Reformation of the Church which Martin V showed any wish to carry into effect was that concerning the cardinals. The papal absolutism over all bishops which Martin V desired to establish aimed at the reduction of the power of the ecclesiastical aristocracy which surrounded the pope's person, and the rules for the conduct of the cardinals issued in 1424 were not meant to be mere waste paper. Martin V succeeded in reducing the power of the cardinals. He paid little heed to their advice, and they were so afraid of him that they stammered like awkward children in his presence. Sometimes he even excluded them altogether. In 1429, he retired from Rome to Ferentino before a pestilence, and forbade any of the cardinals to follow him. Yet all Martin V's injunctions could not purge the Curia from the charge of corruption. Money was necessary for the Pope, and Martin, if he laid aside the grosser forms of extortion, still demanded money on all fair pretexts. The ambassadors at the papal court found it necessary for the conduct of the business to propitiate the Pope by handsome presents on the great festivals of the Church. If any business was to be done, the attention of the Pope and his officials had to be arrested by some valuable gift. Yet Martin showed a care in making ecclesiastical appointments which had not been seen in the popes for the last half century. He did not make his appointments rashly, but inquired about the capacities of the different candidates and the special needs of the districts which they aspired to serve. Even so, Martin V was not always to be trusted. He seemed to delight in humbling bishops before him. He deposed Bishop Anselm of Augsburg, simply because the civic authorities quarreled with him. In England, he conferred on a nephew of his own, aged 14, the rich archdeaconry of Canterbury. Yet Martin was never weary of uttering noble sentiments to the cardinals and those around him. No word was so often on his lips as justice. He would often exclaim to his cardinals, "Love justice, ye who judge the earth." Footnote. Platina, ad suos per saepe conversis, his verbis utebatur, diligite justitiam, qui judicatis terram. Back to main text. In these peaceful works of internal reform and organization, Martin V passed his last years, disturbed only by the thought that the time was drawing near for summoning the promised Council of Basel. Moreover, there was little hope of avoiding it, for the religious conflict in Bohemia had waxed so fierce that it had long been the subject of greatest interest in the politics of Europe. Army after army of the Orthodox had been routed by the Bohemian heretics. Papal legates had in vain raised troops and conducted them to battle. Germany was hopelessly exhausted, and when force had failed, men looked anxiously to see if the liberation could again avail. Martin V ordered the legate in Bohemia, Giuliano Cesarini, to convoke a council at Basel in 1431. But he was not to see its beginnings. He was suddenly struck by apoplexy and died on February 20th, 1431. He was buried in the church of St. John Lateran, where his recumbent effigy in brass still adorns his tomb. End of section 20. Section 21 of A History of the Papacy, Volume 2, by Mandell Creighton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain, read by Pamela Nagami. Book 3, Chapter 2, Martin V and the Papal Restoration, Beginnings of Eugenius IV, 1425 to 1432, Part 2. Martin V was a wise, cautious, and prudent pope. He received the papacy discredited and homeless. He succeeded in establishing it firmly in its old capital, recovering its lost possessions, and restoring some of its old prestige in Europe. This he did by moderation and common sense, combined with a genuine administrative capacity. He was not a brilliant man, but the times did not require brilliancy. He was not personally popular, for he did not much care for the regard or sympathy of those around him, but kept his own counsel and went his own way. He was reserved and had great self-command. When the news of a brother's unexpected death was brought to him early one morning, he composed himself and said Mass as usual. He did not care for men's good opinion, but devoted himself energetically to the details of business. He did not care to do anything splendid, so much as to do all things securely. Yet he rescued the papacy from its fallen condition and laid the foundations for its future power. His strong-willed and arbitrary dealings with other bishops did much to break down the strength of national feeling in ecclesiastical matters, which had been displayed at Constance. He was resolved to make the bishops feel their impotence before the Pope, and the political weakness of European states enabled him to go far in breaking down the machinery of the national churches and asserting for the papacy a supreme control in all ecclesiastical matters. In this way he may be regarded as the founder of the theory of papal omnipotence, which is embodied in modern Ultramontanism. Yet Martin V succeeded rather through the weakness of Europe than through his own strength. He did not awaken suspicion by large schemes, but pursued a quiet policy which was dictated by the existing needs of the papacy and was capable of great extension in the future. Without being a great man, he was an extremely sagacious statesman. He had none of the noble and heroic qualities which would have enabled him to set up the papacy once more as the exponent of the religious aspirations of Europe. But he brought it into accordance with the politics of his time and made it again powerful and respected. There were two opinions in his own days respecting the character of Martin V. Those who had waited anxiously for a thorough reformation of the church looked sadly on Martin's shortcomings and accused him of avarice and self-seeking. Those who regarded his career as a temporal ruler extolled him for his practical virtues, and the epitaph on his tomb called him with some truth, Temporum Suorum Felicitas, the happiness of his times. At the present day, we may be permitted to combine these two opposite judgments and may praise him for what he did, while regretting that he lacked the elevation of mind necessary to enable him to seize the splendid opportunity offered him of doing more. After the funeral of Martin V, the 14 cardinals who were in Rome lost no time in entering into conclave in the church of Santa Maria sopra Minerva. They were still smarting at the recollection of the hard yoke of Martin V, and their one desire was to give themselves an easy master and escape the indignities which they had so long endured. To secure this end, they had recourse to the method which the schism had introduced, of drawing up rules for the conduct of the future pope, which each cardinal signed before proceeding to the election. Each promised, if he were elected pope, to issue a bull within 3 days of his coronation, declaring that he would reform the Roman Curia, would further the work of the approaching council, would appoint cardinals according to the decrees of Constance, would allow his cardinals freedom of speech, and would respect their advice, give them their accustomed revenues, abstain from seizing their goods at death, and consult them about the disposal of the government of the Papal States. We see from these provisions how the cardinals resented the insignificance to which Martin V had consigned them. To reverse his treatment of themselves, they were willing to reverse his entire policy, and bind the future pope to accept in some form the council and the cause of ecclesiastical reform. They entered the conclave on March 1, 1431, and spent the next day in drawing up the instrument for their own protection. On March 3, they proceeded to vote, and on the first scrutiny, Gabriel Candulmier, a Venetian, was unanimously elected. Others had been mentioned, such as Giuliano Cesarini, the energetic legate in Bohemia, and Antonio Casino, Bishop of Siena. But in their prevailing temper, the cardinals determined that it was best to have a harmless non-entity, and all were unanimous that Candulmier answered best to that description. Gabriel Candulmier, who took the name of Eugenius IV, was a Venetian, sprung from a wealthy but not noble family. His father died when he was young, and Gabriel, seized with religious enthusiasm, distributed his wealth, 20,000 ducats, among the poor, and resolved to seek his riches in another world. So great was his ardor that he infected with it his cousin Antonio Correr, and both entered the monastery of St. Giorgio d'Alga in Venice. There the two friends remained simple brothers of the order, till Antonio's uncle was unexpectedly elected Pope Gregory XII. As usual, the papal uncle wished to promote his nephew, but Antonio refused to leave his monastery unless he was accompanied by his friend Candulmier. Gregory XII made his nephew Bishop of Bologna and Candulmier Bishop of Siena. He afterwards prepared the way for his own downfall by insisting on elevating both to the dignity of cardinals. But the diminution of Gregory's obedience gave them small scope for their activity. They both went to Constance and were ranked among the cardinals of the United Church. Their long friendship was at last interrupted by jealousy. Correr could not endure his friend's elevation to the papacy. He left him, and at the Council of Basel was one of his bitterest opponents. Martin V appointed Candulmier to be legate in Bologna, where he showed his capacity by putting down a rebellion of the city. When elected to the papacy at the early age of 47, he was regarded as a man of high religious character, without much knowledge of the world or political capacity. The cardinals considered him to be an excellent appointment for their purpose. Tall and of a commanding figure and pleasant face, he would be admirably suited for public appearances. His reputation for piety would satisfy the reforming party. His known liberality to the poor would make him popular in Rome. His assumed lack of strong character and of personal ambition would assure to the cardinals the freedom and consideration after which they pined. He was in no way a distinguished man, and in an age when learning was becoming more and more respected, he was singularly uncultivated. His early years were spent in the performance of formal acts of piety, and his one literary achievement was that he wrote with his own hand a breviary, which he always continued to use when he became pope. The absence of any decided qualities in Eugenius IV seems to have been so marked that miraculous agency was called in to explain his unexpected elevation. A story which he himself was fond of telling in later years found ready credence. When he was a simple monk at Venice, he took his turn to act as porter at the monastery gate. One day a hermit came and was kindly welcomed by Condulmiere, who accompanied him into the church and joined in his devotions. As they returned, the hermit said, "You will be made cardinal and then pope. In your pontificate you will suffer much adversity." Then he departed and was seen no more. Eugenius IV was faithful to his promise before election, and on the day of his coronation, March 11th, confirmed the document which he had signed in conclave. He also showed signs of a desire to reform the abuses of the papal court. His first act was to cut off a source of exaction. The customary letters announcing his election were given for transmission to the ambassadors of the various states, instead of being sent by papal nuncios, who expected large donations for their service. But the first steps of Eugenius IV in the conduct of affairs showed an absence of wisdom and an unreasoning ferocity. Martin V had been careful to secure the interests of his own relatives. His brother Lorenzo had been made Count of Alba and Celano in the Abruzzi, and his brother Giordano, Duke of Amalfi and Venosa, Prince of Salerno. Both of them died before the Pope, but their places were taken by the sons of Lorenzo, Antonio, who became Prince of Salerno, Odoardo, who inherited Celano and Marzi, and Prospero, who was cardinal at the early age of 22. Martin V had lived by the Church of Santi Apostoli, in a house of moderate pretensions, as the Vatican was too ruinous for occupation. His nephews had a palace hard by. It was natural for a new pope to look with some suspicion on the favorites of his predecessor. But at first all went well between the Colonna and Eugenius IV. The castle of Sant'Angelo was given up to the pope, and a considerable amount of treasure which Martin V had left behind him. But Eugenius IV soon became suspicious. The towns in the papal states grew rebellious when they felt that Martin V's strong hand was relaxed, and Eugenius needed money and soldiers to reduce them to obedience. He suspected that the papal nephews had vast stores of treasure secreted and resolved by a bold stroke to seize it for himself. Stefano Colonna, head of the Palestrina branch of the family, and at variance with the elder branch, was sent to seize the Bishop of Tivoli, Martin's vice-chamberlain, whom he dragged ignominiously through the streets. Eugenius IV angrily rebuked him for his unnecessary violence, and so alienated his wavering loyalty. At the same time, Eugenius demanded of Antonio Colonna that he should give up all the possessions in the papal states with which his uncle had endowed him, Genazzano, Soriano, San Marino, and other fortresses where Eugenius imagined that the papal treasures lay hid. Antonio loudly declared that this was a plot of the Orsini in their hereditary hatred of the Colonna. He denounced the pope as lending himself to their schemes and left Rome hastily to raise forces. He was soon followed by Stefano Colonna, by the Cardinal Prospero, and the other adherents of the family. Gathering their forces, the Colonna attacked the possessions of the Orsini and laid waste the country up to the walls of Rome. Eugenius IV, like Urban VI, had been unexpectedly raised to a position for which his narrowness and inexperience rendered him unfit. Trusting to the general excellence of his intentions, and exulting in the plenitude of his new authority, he acted on the first impulse, and only grew more determined when he met with opposition. He tortured the luckless Bishop of Tivoli almost to death in his prison. He ordered the partisans of the Colonna in Rome to be arrested, and over 200 Roman citizens were put to death on various charges. Stefano Colonna advanced against Rome, seized the Porta Appia on April 23rd, and fought his way through the streets as far as the Piazza of San Marco. But the people did not rise on his side as he had expected. The Pope's troops were still strong enough to drive back their assailants. Stefano Colonna could not succeed in getting hold of the city, but he kept the Appian Gate, laid waste the Campania, and threatened the city with famine. Eugenius IV retaliated by ordering the destruction of the Colonna palaces, even that of Martin V, and the houses of their adherents, and on May 18th issued a decree depriving them of all their possessions. The old times of savage warfare between the Roman nobles were again brought back. The contest might long have raged to the destruction of the newborn prosperity of the Roman city, had not Florence, Venice, and Naples sent troops to aid the Pope. But the Neapolitan forces under Caldora proved a feeble help, for they took money from Antonio Colonna and assumed an ambiguous attitude. In Rome, the confession of a conspiracy to seize the castle of Sant'Angelo and expel the Pope was extorted from a luckless friar and gave rise to fresh prosecutions and imprisonments. Amid these agitations, Eugenius IV was stricken by paralysis, which was put down to the results of poison administered in the interests of the Colonna. Sickness brought reflection, and the Colonnesi on their side saw that the chances of war were going against them, since Venice and Florence were determined to support Eugenius, whose help they needed against the growing power of the Duke of Milan. Accordingly, on September 22nd, peace was made between the Pope and Antonio Colonna, who paid 75,000 ducats and resigned the castles which he held in the Papal States. Giovanna of Naples deprived him also of his principality of Salerno. The relatives of Martin V fell back to their former position. But Eugenius had gained by violence, disorder, bloodshed, and persecution an end which might have been reached equally well by a little patience and tact. The disturbances in the States of the Church gradually settled down, and Eugenius in September was anxiously awaiting the coming of Sigismund to Italy for the purpose of assuming the imperial crown. On his dealings with Sigismund depended his chance of freeing himself from the council, which had begun to assemble at Basel, and whose proceedings were such as to cause him some anxiety. End of section 21.